Hey, gunboats, cruisers, super dreadnoughts, the entire fleet. What the hell? Pete Narrow was staring into the plot in disbelief, and Prescott shook his head. A part of him was actually angry at the bugs for stopping when he'd made up his mind to die. Get in here and get it over with, you bastards. Isn't it enough for you to kill us without screwing around this way? But they were still moving away. Moving away at maximum speed. Sir, the buoys are picking up. My God, sir! What? Prescott snarled, taking out some of his confusion on the hapless lieutenant who'd just spoken. The young woman shook herself and punched commands into her console. Look at your repeater, sir, she said, and Prescott dropped his gaze to the display. Holy Mother of God, he whispered. 34 fresh Orion ships were headed in from the Sock warp point. And not just ships. Over 100 fighters led the way, a combat space patrol sweeping the way for 20 fleet carriers and 14 super dreadnoughts. Can't be, he said softly. Karaza's still over a month out, and he doesn't have anywhere near that much firepower to begin with. Those people can't be there. Well, for people who don't exist, they look mighty good to me, Pit Narrow said jubilantly. In fact, Prescott was right. That huge relief fleet not only couldn't be there, it wasn't. Or rather, it wasn't what it looked like. The massive task force was actually only 3 battleships, 5 CVs, not 20, and 5 CVLs, and 21 battle cruisers and heavy cruisers. They weren't part of Lord Kiniak's force. Indeed, many weren't even combat ready. They were simply everything the tabbies could scrape up. Convoy escorts, training ships, vessels snatched out of the Bureau of Repair's hands, anything. None of the CVLs had any fighters. The battlecruiser's magazines were less than 2/3 filled, and 2 battleships still had repair techs aboard. But they all mounted 3rd-generation ECM, and the tabbies had it online in deception mode. A bluff, Prescott thought 2 days later as he stood in Horned Viper's boat bay. The whole thing was a colossal bluff. I don't think I'll ever play poker with a tabby. He smiled at the thought, then straightened, leaning heavily on his cane, as the Orion cutter settled into its cradle and the side party came to attention. Great Claw Zarnak Diano stepped out into the twitter of bosun's pipes. He saluted sharply, and Prescott ignored the pain in his leg as he came to attention and returned the courtesy.
"Permission to come aboard, sir," the tabby yowled to Captain Pete Narrow.
"Granted, sir," Pete Narrow replied, and Zarnak stepped over the line on the deck. The pipes fell silent, and deafening quiet filled the bay as Zarnak crossed to Prescott. He stopped and gazed into the Admiral's eyes for a moment, then drew his Defargo, the honor dirk of an Orion warrior. The wickedly keen blade gleamed in his hand, and he spoke quietly.
When I was told human ships had arrived to support me, Admiral Prescott, I accepted them only because I had no choice, for such aid was an insult to my honor and that of my clan. Any allies were better than none, yet I swore to my clan fathers that the day I no longer needed your assistance, I would spit upon your shadow. I would not challenge you as I would one of the Zirluku Valkanai, for I knew you would not accept challenge if I offered it, and it would only insult my honor further if you had.
Prescott's mouth tightened, but he said nothing. He simply stared into Zarnak's slit-pupiled eyes, waiting, and the Orion moved his ears slowly back and forth.
Humans are cowards and chofaki, Fang Prescott. I did not think they are. I knew they are, as surely as I know my own name. But what I knew to be true was a lie, and black dishonor to your people.
He flipped the Defargo to extend its hilt to the Terran, the formal gesture of a liegeman to his lord, and his eyes met Prescott's unflinchingly.
There are no Chofaki here, clan brother. There are only Farshatok. Your honor is our honor, and if ever Clandiano can serve you or yours with treasure or blood, we are yours to command.
Chapter 27. It is about honor. The command balcony of the great orbital station looked out over an expanse of control consoles and computer terminals. Beyond them was a great curving transparency showing the sun of Idnok, its glare suitably stepped down. It was by the reflected light of that sun that 10th Great Fang of the Khan Koraza Kinyak, Kanaku Kinyak, could see with naked eyes the ships of his command, that which was to be the Grand Alliance's third fleet. Those ships had been straggling in since shortly after the ships of the enemy, the humans called Bugs, had entered the Kleon system with their cargo of nightmare. The Navy had begun assembling all available ships here at the sector capital immediately after Zarnak Diano sent forth the alarm. Then, with the delay built into all interstellar communications, had come the response of the Grand Allied Joint Chiefs of Staff. They'd recognized at once that the war had acquired a second front even more squarely within the domain of the Zirlukuvalkanai than the original one was within human space. So a new fleet, a fleet of the Khanate, just as Admiral Murakuma's was a fleet of the Federation, had been added to the Alliance's organizational structure, and the Khan had honored Koraza by entrusting him with its command. Still, he reflected, it would have been nice if Third Fleet had been anything more than an organization chart when he arrived here. The ancient Terran military theorist Sun Tzu, who had finally won acceptance in Koraza's service, despite the seeming contradictions between his precepts and Far Shalakia, had observed that numbers alone confer no advantage in war, and the ever-increasing number of ships whose flanks reflected the light of Idnok's sun had built up to an impressive total, essentially everything in the sector capable of movement, but had never functioned as a fleet before. His hastily assembled staff would have been lucky to get all of them moving in the same direction on the same day, and any sort of coordinated maneuvers would have been impossible without the merciless exercises Koraza had laid on. But those indispensable exercises had required still more time, and time was precisely what Zarnak Diano, and to an even greater extent the civilians of Hernau and any surviving Telmazans, did not have. It was, thought Koraza, who was something of a military history enthusiast, a lesson the Terrans had taught the Zirlukuvalkanai in the Wars of Shame. His people, too long accustomed to expanding at the expense of unworthy opponents, and therefore inclined to take the old hero sagas literally, had thought of ships as individual swords to be wielded by the champions who commanded them. They had forgotten the long-term coordinated training necessary to provide the fleet and squadron organization, which was to a navy as tempering was to a blade. The thought of Terrans brought a smile to Koraza's lips. He knew Zarnak Diano, and when he'd heard that the first crucial reinforcements that could be gotten to the Great Claw were Terran units, he'd seen disaster looming. Zarnak might not be quite so reactionary as his father in most things, but he seemed determined not to excel the old Kanaku Diano in unreasoning hatred of humans, which would have been impossible, but to equal him. Koraza had known, with a horrible sinking certainty, that Zarnak would not only bring about military calamity, but also dishonor the Khan by insulting an ally. The latter had worried the Great Fang almost as much as the former, for however much he consciously rejected the narrow and rigid Farshalakia of his ancestors in favor of modern rationalism, he could no more free himself of it than he could free himself of those ancestors' genetic legacy. So it had been with incredulous relief that Koraza had read Zarnak's last few reports with their steady change in tone. He was looking forward to meeting this human Great Claw, or Rear Admiral, as they called it in their unpronounceable tongue, who had brought about that which he would once have unhesitatingly declared impossible, and in little more than 3 local days he and Third Fleet would set out to do just that. The communications officer broke in on Koraza's thoughts.
"Your pardon, Great Fang," said the young son of the Khan.
Lieutenant Commander, Kurraza thought, his mind continuing to crank out title equivalencies in the outlandish Terran rank structure. But Governor Karzan requests a moment of your time. Quaraza's whiskers twitched with annoyance. As long as Third Fleet was located within the Idnok sector, and most especially while it was assembling at the sector's capital, a degree of jurisdictional friction between the fleet commander and the sector governor was inevitable. In this case, differences in temperament made the situation worse than it had to be. He turned resignedly to face the hollow imager, and moved within the pickup.
"Put him on," he ordered, and the governor of the Idnok sector seemed to flash into existence.
"Governor Karzan," Kurraza greeted,
touching clenched fist to chest in salute. The huge orbital station could accommodate the bulky hollow imager for which warships had too little space to spare, but it was in geostationary orbit around Idnok, about a quarter of a second passed while the message came and went, imposing a delay which was barely noticeable, yet spoiled the illusion that Karzan was here on the command balcony rather than in his palace on the surface. He responded to Karaza's salute with a courtesy that verged on unctuousness.
"Greetings, Great Fang. I have no wish to disrupt your busy schedule, but I have not yet received a confirmation that you have dispatched the Great Claw Zarnak the orders we agreed on. I'm sure you have done so, as we agreed," he added with pointed repetition. "But I felt obliged to confirm it personally."
Kurraza sighed inwardly. He had agreed, albeit with a reluctance that had caused him to put off actually keeping his promise.
"Your pardon, Governor, but the press of my duties has prevented me from actually sending the dispatch. I have, however, prepared the necessary orders to Great Claw Zarnak. Stand on the defensive in Alawan, attempting no counteroffensive before I arrive."
He drew a breath.
"Governor, I will, of course, send the orders if you insist on holding me to my promise, but perhaps we should reconsider. Remember, every day the enemy is left undisturbed in Telmaza is another opportunity for him to discover the Hernau warp point. Some aggressive raiding at Zarnak's discretion might distract the enemy from survey activities."
Karzan's habitual blandness was beginning to look a little frayed around the edges.
"As I argued at our previous discussion, Great Fang, we have no way of knowing that the enemy has not already discovered the Hernau system. More to the point, until Third Fleet arrives in Alawan, Great Claw Zarnak's force is the sector's only defense. It cannot be hazarded on premature adventures. And while I have hesitated to raise this point before, I fear Zarnak's discretion cannot be relied on in this matter."
He hastily raised a clawed hand.
"Yes, I know you are honor-bound to defend a fellow officer. It does you credit. But consider, his withdrawal from Clean and Telmaza flew in the face of his temperament as well as Farshalakia. The fact that he had no choice cannot possibly compensate in his own mind. He is bound to be biased towards reckless displays of courage, seeking to wipe out the stain, however illusory, on his honor. Under the circumstances, the knowledge that your command will soon depart Idnok may well goad him into such an action, independently rather than encourage him to hold fast."
Kurraza opened his mouth to hotly declare that Zarnak, like all officers of the Khan, was well aware of his paramount duty to defend the race's inhabited worlds, then snapped it shut. For Karzan, damn him, had a point. Zarnak was aggressive by nature, and any imagined disgrace would make him even more so. He might not do anything culpably stupid, but he might well overestimate his own strength in order to rationalize his need for action. And according to the latest reports, that strength was insufficient for any serious attempt on Telmaza. No, Zarnak's guilt over the worlds he had been forced to leave to their deaths could not be allowed to imperil still more worlds. It was a truth to which the Zirlukuvalkanai had never really become reconciled. The higher one climbed on the ladder of rank, the more often honor had to be sacrificed on the altar of duty. Khorraza himself had yet to accept it gracefully.
"Your points are well taken, Governor," he said leadenly.
"I will send the orders."
Raymond Prescott began to rise, struggling with his wounded leg, as Zarnak Diano entered the briefing room, but the Great Claw waved him back.
"Sit, Great Claw."
The Orion title came more naturally to Zarnak than the Terran one, and he smiled a fang-hidden smile as Prescott sank back.
"After all," he added dryly, "it is I who should rise when you enter."
"Nonsense," Prescott said.
"The task force is overwhelmingly Zirlukuvalkanai and Gorm, and the fixed defenses are wholly Orion. If only because of communication problems, you must retain command."
"You are a strange being, Great Claw," Zarnak said. "Are all humans like you?"
"We humans are a pretty confusing lot," Prescott replied with a smile. "But yes, I think most of my people are much like me where it matters."
"Then it is my loss that I have not made myself more familiar with them."
Zarnak's tone was serious, not a polite formula, and Prescott bobbed a small Orion-style bow. Then Zarnak inhaled sharply and lowered himself into a chair.
"You have seen Least Claw Uaria's report."
"I have."
"And your opinion?"
"I believe she may have a point," Prescott said after only the briefest hesitation. "While any rational foe might have avoided action against Claw Dera's apparent fighter strength, the bugs have appeared willing to date to accept total annihilation in order to inflict attritional losses. And even if they believed Dara's force was overwhelming, they could have forced us to engage on their terms, or abandon the twins and the fleet base before he intervened."
"True."
Zarnak tipped his chair back, claws kneading its armrests gently.
"So why decline to attack? Unless, of course, Uaria is correct."
Prescott nodded, wishing fervently that Eloise Kamak were still available. But while she was expected to recover fully, she would be out of action for months. He'd borrowed Lieutenant Commander Cruikshank from Diego Jackson to replace her. But Cruikshank was less comfortable with the Orion language. He also lacked Kamak's unorthodox imagination, and Prescott had always preferred intelligence officers who thought outside the boxes of conventional wisdom. He missed Eloise badly, but it seemed Least Claw Uaria had the same ability. He cocked his own chair back in thought. As Zarnak said, the bugs had to have known they could carry through against the twins. Based on every other battle they'd fought, that was precisely what they ought to have done, and Uaria had been the first to ask why they hadn't. The only answer she'd been able to come up with was that, for some reason, this time they were unwilling to risk crippling losses. That was very unlike them, yet they couldn't have expected to contact the Alliance in Shanak, which suggested one possible explanation. If this contact had been as unexpected for them as for the Alliance, then they must have attacked with whatever was available, and if it was all an opportunistic response to an unanticipated opening, they might well have broken off because there were no, or very few, additional mobile units behind them. And if that were so...
"I think we must assume, tentatively at least, that Uaria is correct," he said finally. "If she is, it might also explain why they have not reinforced and attempted Alawan a second time."
Zarnak flicked his ears in agreement. Over a Terran month had passed since the enemy had pulled back, and during his inactivity, Lord Kiniak's forces had completed assembling. They would reach Alawan within 2 weeks, and more reinforcements had arrived in the meantime than Zarnak had believed possible. Orion, Gorm, even a few additional human starships had come in, and some, like the Gorm super dreadnoughts Clairding and Datum, had been totally unexpected. They had been beyond New Bristol, in human space, when the call went out, and communications had been so chaotic no one had realized they were responding. Which was probably as well. If anyone had realized, they would no doubt have been diverted to Idnak. The human support ships had also arrived and labored mightily. Zarnak was deeply impressed by how rapidly they had put the wounded human ships back into action. yet the other thing they had achieved was almost more important. The joint human Orion R&D teams had finally determined how to make TFN and Con Command Data Link interface, and the humans' mobile shipyards had worked out jury-rigged field modifications. No doubt the official version would be much neater, but the human tech's crude version worked. The ships under Zarnok's command could now be formed into battle groups on a tactical basis, rather than being forced to operate as separate national units, and the value of that would be difficult to exaggerate. He was not certain he could have stopped a full-scale warp point assault, but Idnok at New Bristol had sent up sufficient fighters to refill every hangar in Alawan. With that much fighter strength, backed by his hybrid battle line and, if necessary, the fixed defenses, he felt confident he could hold the system, even if he were forced to concede the warp point. "And that is why Uaria's theory is so convincing. The bugs must realize we are straining every sinew to reinforce, and they would not have given us time to do so unless they had to."
"If," Zarnok said very carefully, "the enemy is indeed too weak to attack us, is it not possible he might be weak enough for us to attack him?"
He watched Prescott's face. He was learning gradually to interpret human expressions, but nothing he had so far learned was of much help at the moment, and he wondered how Prescott would have fared across the Eskai table. Probably quite well. I doubt even another human could tell his thoughts just now. "I suppose," Prescott said after a moment, "that the possibility must exist. Of course, if we suggested as much, our superiors would no doubt find the evidence insufficient, particularly with such heavy reinforcements en route. I suspect they would order us to hold our position until relieved, rather than risk our ships on any such hypothetical speculation by a mere least claw."
"Your command of the Tongue of Tongues is most impressive, Great Claw Prescott," Zarnok remarked. "And your assessment of Sector Command's probable reaction is astute. We are, of course, merely discussing possibilities, and I feel sure Lord Kiniak would be more, adventurous than Governor Karsan. Unfortunately, it is Karsan who holds final authority."
"I see," Prescott pursed his lips. "My people are not unfamiliar with such situations," he observed, "and we have a saying we sometimes use. What your superiors do not know about, they cannot countermand. The translation is not exact, but I believe the meaning comes through."
"Indeed," Zarnok gave a purring chuckle. "Interesting. There is a similar saying among the Zirluku Valkanai. Actions taken without orders are not taken against them."
"Perhaps our peoples are more alike than most think," Prescott replied, then met Zarnok's eyes levelly. "But however that may be, what we are considering constitutes a grave risk, not simply to our commands, but to Alawan. If we attempt Telmaza..." Zarnok's ears twitched at the confirmation that they were, in fact, thinking the same thing. "And take heavy losses. We may expose this system to a bug counterattack."
"Truth," Zarnok said seriously, "and I cannot and will not order you to support me in this. Not only are you my superior, despite your willingness to allow me to retain command, but the risk to your ships and personnel would be great, as would the risk to your career."
Prescott made a dismissive gesture, but Zarnok continued in the same earnest tone.
"Do not make light of it, Great Claw Prescott. I think human and Zirluku Valkanai Admiralty boards are alike in that much. Success justifies all, yet failure blots out even past accomplishments."
"There is a time to consider careers," Prescott said, "and one to consider duty."
"You speak truly," Zarnok said, "and you are also correct about the risk to Alawan. Yet I cannot forget Cleon, or Hernau. We do not know if the enemy has discovered Hernau exists. Even if he has, he may not yet have had time to wreak much damage there. But he has been in possession of Cleon for over 3 of your months,
and there are 4 billion of my people in that system. If we could retake Telmaza before Lord Kiniak arrives here, he would begin his own operations only 1 warp-point assault from Cleon, not 2. And if the enemy has not in fact learned of Hairnau's existence, we would protect 1.5 billion of my people. Those are the prizes against which we would hazard our commands.
Prescott leaned back, eyes hooded, and considered the tabby's quietly impassioned plea. And plea it was, he thought. The Alawan fleet base had produced a few dozen SBM Hawks, but it was now only getting into full production. Yet New Bristol had stripped its own magazines bare and rushed the weapons forward. Over 200 TFN pods had reached Alawan, and only the lavish use of those pods could possibly get them into Telmaza intact. Without Prescott's support, Zarnok couldn't possibly attack. Even with it, the odds against success would be high. Yet Zarnok was also right about Cleon and Hairnau. Every day that passed could be the literal difference between life and death for millions of Orion civilians, and he suddenly realized there was one argument Zarnok hadn't made. Honor. Zarnok Diano had pulled out of Cleon and Telmaza rather than fight to the death. His successful defense of Alawan might have vindicated his decision, yet honor and vindication weren't necessarily the same thing, particularly to a tabby. But if he fought his way back into Telmaza, that, coupled with the Battle of Alawan, would cleanse his honor. Yet he hadn't made that argument, and as he looked into Zarnok's eyes, Prescott realized he wouldn't make it. Not because he felt it would have no impact on a Terran, for by now he knew how intimately Prescott had studied Orion culture and the Farshalakia. He knew Prescott would understand the centrality of honor, his clan's even more than his own, to any Orion. But his concern was with lives, billions of them. Orion or no, Zarnok Diano had set his honor aside. Indeed, he was risking even greater dishonor, for if he made the attempt and failed, all too many of his fellows would consider him a total, feckless bungler. Very few Terrans would have understood the immensity of the self-sacrifice he was prepared to embrace. But Raymond Porter Prescott was one of them. "Death is lighter than a flower, but duty is heavier than a mountain," he said softly. Zarnok's ears cocked questioningly, and Prescott smiled. "A saying from old Terra, Great Claw, from some of my people I think you would have understood." "This is not about honor," Zarnok said quietly, but Prescott shook his head. "No, Great Claw, it is about honor and duty. One may sometimes clash with the other in the eyes of others, but it is our eyes we must consider here." He held the tabby's slit-pupiled eyes for a moment, then punched a code into his comm without looking down. A moment passed, and then a voice spoke from the terminal.
"Yes, sir."
"Greatclaw Zarnok and I are in briefing room A, Alec," Prescott said. "Please collect Crookshank and join us. We have an operation to plan."
Chapter 28
A Good Day for It.
The fleet waited far behind its heavy cruiser screen, for it was uneasily aware of its exposure. Pre-war doctrine would have moved its entire strength into range of the warp point. As it was, the decision to defend the system at all had come hard. The fleet was too weak to risk a conventional deployment against missile pods, and the temptation to fall back into the first system it had seized was great. Yet the advantages of holding here, if it could, were also great. At best, it would win time for its reinforcements to arrive. At worst, the enemy still had no idea where the second closed warp point in the contact system was. And if the fleet had not yet received the warships it needed, it had received the new missiles to support its gunboats. This time it was an Orion show, and Raymond Prescott leaned on his cane on Horned Viper's patched-up flag bridge as Task Force 37 headed for the Telmaza warp point. He and Zarnok had agonized over the timing, for if they failed and Yuaria's theory was wrong, Alawan would certainly be counterattacked. The fleet base's fighter strength had been tripled, and tenders were prepared to ferry fighters from Sak to Alawan to replace losses, which should give the base a chance against whatever the bugs had left after destroying TF-37. Yet neither Prescott nor Zanuck could free themselves of concern for the system. That was why they'd waited almost another week. Lord Kiniak must be en route now, and despite their burning need to relieve Hernow, they delayed to buy a little more time for him to arrive. They were still cutting it close, but if in fact the bugs hadn't yet discovered Hernow, the risk was worth it. And whatever happened, he thought grimly, TF-37, and especially its tabbies, would take a lot of killing before it went down. Of the 80-plus ships in his display, 62% were Orion. It had taken the assistance of his mobile shipyards to get them all ready in time, but 13 of TF-37's 21 carriers and 14 of its 21 battlecruisers were Orion. Combining their battle line units' light fighter components with their carrier strike groups, the tabbies also accounted for 83 of the task force's 110 fighter squadrons, and they'd managed to scare up 4 battleships as well. Of course, Khan's Ambrish had repair techs on board even now, but the battleship's captain insisted she was ready to fight, just as the COs of the CVL Rordenau and Volgar insisted their ships were. Neither carrier had had a single fighter embarked when she arrived, and 2 of Volgar's catapults were iffy, but no tabby was going to sit this one out. They'd seen the imagery from Cleon. They knew what was happening there, and might be happening in Hernow as well, and the devil himself wouldn't stop them. Prescott understood that, and he was glad he'd insisted Zanuck retain command. The Battle of Alawan had earned his personnel enormous respect from their Orion allies, but as he told the Great Claw, TF-37's composition made it unthinkable for him to demand command authority. Not only was it a predominantly Orion force, but he himself was the only one of his officers who could actually speak Orion, and he'd been hard-pressed to find enough Orion-cognizant personnel just to fill the critical communication slots aboard his ships. But Zanuck had done a little reshuffling of his own personnel when he reorganized his task groups. Prescott's TG-37.2 had given up its CVLs, its surviving battlecruisers, and 2 of its DDEs, to Zarnak's TG-37.1. It made sense to combine all the carriers in one force, and the broadsword's energy weapons and short-ranged missile batteries would be more useful covering the fighter platforms against gunboats than going toe-to-toe with archers. And Prescott couldn't complain about what he'd gotten in return. 2 GSN super dreadnoughts, Gormus-class ships with heavy energy batteries and no capital missiles, perhaps, but still formidable units. 4 Orion battleships, 7 Orion and Gorm battle cruisers, all missile ships, and 17 Orion heavy and light cruisers to supplement the 4 Swiftsure-class CAs New Bristol had scared up. Despite the pounding his original command had taken, his new task group was far more powerful, and every one of its allied ships had at least one comm officer who understood standard English. "Even so, I'm glad I reminded my TAC officers to stay away from contractions," he mused. Contractions and homonyms, neither of which the tongue of tongues used, could give English-cognizant Orions enormous trouble, and with their emotions running as high as they were. Of course, our emotions are pretty high, too. I probably should have looked closer at Mexicano's readiness report. I'm pretty sure Captain Train did a little creative editing to get in on this one. But a battleship's a battleship, and we need everything we've got. He limped from the plot to his command chair and settled back with a sigh of relief. A yeoman hung his cane on the shock frame for him, and he brought up his link to CIC. The senior plotting officer looked up as it came online, but Prescott only nodded to him. Commander Hyler nodded back and returned his attention to his own console, and Prescott checked the time. 32 minutes.
"Very well, Great Claw Prescott," Zarnok said formally. "Engage?"
"Yes, sir." Prescott looked at Alec Lefroy, his acting chief of staff as well as his ops officer, and nodded.
"Launch your birds, Alec."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Lefroy punched a stud, and 120 Terran SBM Hawk pods carried 600 AAM Warhead SBMs into Tel Maza in a single mighty wave. None of the Orion pinnaces which had probed Tel Maza had survived, which suggested a massive gunboat CSP beyond it, and Leastclaw Thera had suggested programming at least some pods to go after those gunboats, but Lafroy had countered that they didn't know for certain that the pods would track on them. Even if they would, it would have required at least one full pod to ensure the destruction of each gunboat, which could easily spread them too thin. The TFN pod techs swore their birds would home on gunboats, but they had to admit they couldn't prove it. And Lafroy was right about the dispersion effect. More, he and Thera agreed the bugs would have used their heavy cruiser OWPs to cover the warp point, and the Terran had successfully argued in favor of targeting the pods on them. In return, Zarnok had decreed that only half their total SBM Hawks would be used in the first strike. 600 missiles should account for the cruisers, especially when surprise was hopefully complete. The remaining pods would be held back to cover a retreat at need. Now the SBM Hawks vanished, and TG-37.2, Grand Alliance, accelerated towards the warp point on their heels. The sudden eruption of missile pods caught the fleet unaware, for the enemy had ceased expending reconnaissance pinnaces 6 days ago, and the fleet had taken his inactivity to indicate he had no thought of an attack. The gunboat CSP was only 30 units strong, and many were out of position to intercept before the pods stabilized. Less than a dozen pods were picked off before the survivors fired, and most of the cruisers were still rushing to general quarters when the missiles came in. In direct contravention of normal tactics, Zarnok and Prescott had chosen to send TG-37.2's lighter ships through first. They had no choice, for they had too few capital ships to expose them to the first terrible embrace. Only 11 of the bug cruisers Allied Intelligence had codenamed Danger survived the opening bombardment, and all were damaged. 4 had not yet brought their offensive weapons online when the first Allied cruiser appeared, but the other 7 opened fire instantly, and each mounted no less than 16 of the short-ranged plasma guns. TFNS Amiralio di Saint Bon and Peder Scram died without getting a shot off, and TFNS Eidsvold and Kons Dibniha fired only a single broadside apiece before following them into destruction. But each of those broadsides finished off an active bug CA, and their consorts flooded forward, firing savagely. Within 90 seconds, every bug starship on the warp point was dead. Yet that left the gunboats Thera had wanted to target. They came slashing in with heavy loads of close-attack missiles, driving in through the thunder of the Allied missile launchers to launch at point-blank range, then closed to ram. Only a few got through, but a few were too many. Kons Athnak, Noizua, Vertigo, and Pilko were destroyed outright, and the air-bleeding wrecks of TFNS Voltaire, the only Terran CA to survive, turned to limp back to Alawan. "The cruisers have cleared the warp point, sir," Lafroy reported, and Prescott nodded grimly. Returning courier drones tallied the dreadful price his lead waves had paid. But they'd done their job, and their sensors confirmed that the nearest super-dreadnought was over 2 light-minutes out. That was good, because he needed all the time he could get to clear lanes through the mines. Only the TFN's ships could fire the internally launched AMBAM, yet each of his battleships mounted only a single capital missile launcher. Designed to deploy decoy-enhanced drive missiles as a defensive measure, those 7 launchers were all he had to fire AMBAMs, and if the bugs had been close enough to hammer his battle line while it was still pinned down on the warp point, the entire operation would have had to be scrubbed. But they weren't, and he nodded to Captain Pitnaro's comm image. "Take us through, Jason." It was disturbing that the enemy had finally realized it made more sense to lead attacks with expendable units, for that indicated he was evolving better tactics. But the battleships which followed suggested he had no super-dreadnought element of his own. In turn, that suggested he had not been strongly reinforced. If that was true, the new missiles should make it relatively easy to hold this system after all, and the fleet launched its ready-duty gunboats in a solid wave. They're moving in on us, sir. Looks like they're sending in the gunboats first.
Understood. Prescott acknowledged Lefroy's report almost absently. It was the ops officer's job to make it, but there was nothing Prescott could do about it. The Belials were clearing mines as fast as they could, but they were taking much longer than Matterhorn-class super-dreadnoughts would have. Have all the cripples cleared back to Alawan?
Yes, sir. Dushai and Juzevan didn't want to go, but they're clear.
Good. Prescott watched his escorts form up to screen the battle line and shook his head. Tabbies. Neither of those ships had more than 2 launchers left, and they still wanted to stay.
3 more salvos and Alpha Lane will be through the field, sir, Pitnarau reported.
Beta and Charlie?
They're badly behind, Pitnarau admitted,
and Prescott frowned. Forget them, then. We need maneuvering room. Move us out through Alpha now. The enemy's units, including a mere 2 SDs, streamed through the minefield gap before the gunboats could attack. Some of his ships launched attack craft, but there were no more than 30 of them, and 80 gunboats streaked to meet them.
"Here they come," Lefroy said, and Horned Viper twitched as TG-37.2 belched missiles.
The understrength fighter squadrons from the Tabby battleships and battlecruisers raced towards the gunboats as well, and fireballs pocked the bug formation. But the kill numbers were lower than they should have been against such fragile targets, and the strike came on grimly.
That damn point defense of theirs, Prescott thought bitterly, and looked at Pitnarau.
Zulu 4, Jason.
Aye, aye, sir. Executing Zulu 4.
TG-37.2 turned away from the gunboats, maneuvering to hold the range open while missiles and Tabby fighters tore into them. The vector shift seemed to surprise the bugs, and they lost precious seconds correcting, and the defenders used those seconds well. Only 21 attackers broke through, and they flung themselves upon the 2 Gorm Leviathans, which dominated Prescott's formation. But a Gormus class was a dangerous opponent for anyone, especially something the size of a gunboat. Heavy energy batteries and shoals of missiles exploded into the bugs' faces, backed by the point defense of the entire battle line. GSNS Datum lost most of her shields and took some armor damage, but she and her sister, supported by the 4 Orion battleships data-linked to them, blew the gunboats into vapor before they could ram.
All right!
Someone shouted from CIC, but Prescott's face was carved iron, for another wave was coming in, and this one was 3 times as strong.
Looks like we find out if the techs were right, Alec, he said quietly,
then raised his voice.
Zulu 5, Captain Pitnarau!
The first mass strike was a disappointment, but it seemed to have confused the enemy. He recoiled, turning still further away, foolishly circling around behind the warp point. If he meant to retreat, he should have reversed course down his cleared lane and escaped the system entirely. Surely he did not expect the fleet's own mines to deter its gunboats. Apparently he did. He was trying to use the mines as a shield, and no doubt they would kill a few gunboats. At their speed, IFF gear was not fully reliable, and some mines were likely to attack them, but not enough to make any difference. And once they reached the warp point, they could block the enemy's retreat and swamp any additional enemy starships if they tried to make transit to support the units already in the system.
Launch, Prescott said,
and a dozen courier drones flicked through to Alawan just as the gunboats hit the minefield. 6 or 7 were blown apart by their own mines, but the others screamed across the field to attack TG-37.2, and this time more got through. Most of the Tabby fighters were destroyed in a wild melee amid the mines, but they took out another 40 gunboats first, and the Allied battle line's missiles and energy weapons met the survivors furiously. The bugs slashed in, ignoring the screen to go after battleships, and once more the 2 super dreadnoughts acted as magnets for their fury. But before they could reach their targets, a fresh wave of SBM Hawks erupted from the warp point behind them. The timing wasn't perfect. The pods were supposed to have caught the bugs before they penetrated TG-37.2's perimeter, and they launched late. But the techs had been right. They could target gunboats, and the delayed launch actually increased their effectiveness, for gunboats, too, had blind spots,
and the missiles drove straight up them. One entire flank of Prescott's formation was a solid wall of glaring detonations as SBMs chased the bugs in among his starships. Two of his battlecruisers got in the way of their own SBMs and took hits that shook them to their keels. But their shields held, and their tactical officers went right on pouring fire into the bugs. Dathum's last shield went down, and two gunboats got through the ramming attacks as well, damaging her drive and ripping at her hull. Her armor buckled, but she shook off the damage, holding her station. Khan's Fikar was less fortunate. A tornado of missiles battered the tabby battleship's shields flat, smashed her armor, and tore deep into her hull. She staggered in extremis, and her agony drew the attention of other gunboats. They howled in, ramming again and again, and suddenly one of them reached her magazines. Every antimatter warhead detonated at once, and the fireball licked away another half-dozen bugs as she died. Fikar was gone, and three of Prescott's battlecruisers were mangled wrecks, but the combination of TG-37.2's defensive fire and the unexpected SBM hawks proved decisive. The remnants of the bug strike broke off, fleeing back to its own battle line, and Prescott drew a deep, shuddering breath. He'd been hurt, but the core of his task group was intact, and that had to have been the bulk of the bug's gunboats. Of course, he thought as the enemy super dreadnought started forward, that leaves the rest of their damn fleet. "Damage report from Dathum," he demanded. "She's lost an engine room, but she's still as fast as we are," Lefroy replied. "Damage control is bringing her shields back up now. Her armor's a sieve, but most of her weapons are in one piece, and Captain Harmack says he's still combat capable." "Good, we're going to need him. Calm, send the second flight drones." The gunboats had proved less effective than anticipated, and the proof that the missile pods could target them had grim implications for future actions. But the enemy remained too weak to meet the fleet's battle line head-on, and 38 super dreadnoughts and 3 battlecruisers started forward, screened by their light cruisers.
"Great Claw Prescott has done well," Zarnak purred, studying the drone readouts.
He and his human ally had structured TG-37.2 as a mace to smash through the shell of the defenses, but TG-37.1 was a rapier, and it was time to bring it into play.
"We will advance, Thera."
21 carriers and their escorts scorched into the warp point at max. The fleet paused as fresh enemy units suddenly materialized and began launching attack craft. The gunboats were still fleeing back to the 12 battlecruisers detached to rearm them, and the fleet could not reach the warp point before these new enemies completed transit. It could neither seal the point against them nor afford to be destroyed if the new missiles proved ineffective, so it turned ponderously away, retreating until it saw how well the new technology worked. There would be time to return to the warp point if the missiles fulfilled predictions.
Raymond Prescott heaved a surreptitious sigh as Zarnak made transit, molested only by a handful of gunboats. Stragglers from the last bug strike tried to penetrate to the carriers, but the old cliché about the snowflake in hell came to mind as the tabby squadrons pounced on them. The task groups made rendezvous, and Prescott scratched the unshaven side of his head as he studied the plot. The bugs were moving slowly away from the warp point, rather than trying to close. They'd never done that before. And something seemed to crawl down the back of his neck as minutes dragged past without a single offensive act out of them. Zarnak held his own force on the warp point while his recon fighters swept outward to assure him no cloaked bugs waited to pounce. But somehow Prescott was sure none did. Yet if not, what were the bastards up to?
"Great Claw Prescott," he turned from the plot to his comm as Zarnak appeared on it.
"Yes, sir."
"My pilots have swept a light-minute sphere without contact. Least Claw Thera and Commodore Jackson agree it is time to launch the next phase. Do you concur?"
"Of course, sir. However..." Prescott paused a moment, rubbing his upper lip, then shrugged. "I urge caution," he said.
They are not reacting in usual fashion, and I distrust an enemy who does exactly what I want him to do.
Most surprises represent only misinterpretations of known data, Zarnak agreed. Yet if they wish to stand, we can only attack and discover what it is they wish us to misinterpret.
Truth, Great Claw. Strike deep. The enemy was finally ready, but his delay had been helpful. The gunboat's greatest tactical limitation was its inability to dock internally. To rearm, it must return to its mothership's external rack, and the mothership must shut down her drive to reload its ordnance racks. The enemy probably had not learned that, yet, but his tardiness was still of immense value. Though not, it was to be hoped, as much value as the new missiles.
The Zirlukuvalkanai would launch the first strike. It was less a matter of honor than of practicality, for there were far more Orion fighters, and the chance of confusion between pilots who couldn't speak one another's languages had to be minimized. The less numerous Terrans were detailed as the task forces covering CSP for the opening phase. Once the bugs had been hammered a time or two and their gunboats had been finished off, Commodore Jackson's strike groups could be used to help complete their destruction. Besides, there would be more than enough action to go around. Raymond Prescott watched 300 Tabby strike fighters arrow into the attack. Leastclaw, Thera, and Zarnak had studied Fifth Fleet's combat reports intensively. They knew how dangerous the cataphracts were, and they'd taken a page from Admiral Murakuma's book. Their pilots would go for the screen, using longer-ranged FM-2s to pick off the carbines, cannons, cleavers first, then go for the cataphracts with frams. It was a good plan, and it came apart the instant the fighters tried to execute it. The attack craft flashed closer. Their targets were obvious, and the screen adjusted its formation slightly. There were only 18 cataphracts, and 24 carbines formed a solid wall between them and the enemy, daring him to waste his fire upon them.
Farshadkanag Iausa Herniak led the attack.
G-forces drew his lips back, baring his fangs, and his eyes glowed as the bugs shifted formation.
The Dershnaki were actually moving his designated targets out where he could get at them. Wait, what was that?
Iausa never finished the question, as the very first bug Afhawk ever used in action scored a direct hit on his fighter.
Prescott slammed his fist down on the arm of his command chair.
Afhawks! The bastards had Afhawks! No wonder they hadn't tried to attack. They'd been waiting to spring their ambush when Task Force 37 attacked.
Surprise was total. It shouldn't have been. He and Zarnak should have allowed for the possibility. But so little time had passed since the Battle of Alawan that such a radical shift in the tactical balance hadn't even occurred to them, and Zarnak's pilots paid a fearful price. The missile-heavy carbines, suddenly infinitely more dangerous than the cataphracts, poured devastating fire into the lead squadrons, and the fighters had known they were beyond threat range. None had even taken evasive action, and 71 died in the first terrible salvo. The survivors reacted like the elite pilots they were. They broke instantly in apparently total confusion, only to drop into the Orion version of the TFN's Waldeck weave. They twisted their base vectors together in a tangle of competing target sources to confuse the enemy's fire control, and despite their shock, carried through against their targets. Some managed to break lock, maneuvering hard against the Afhawks, which had acquired them. Others were less fortunate. But none turned aside, and the survivors salvoed their missiles into their briefed targets. The bug screen writhed as the Orion fire struck. Half the carbines were destroyed outright, and most of the rest were damaged. But none were supposed to have lived, and the kills had cost 3 times the projected losses. Worse, the cost of killing the rest of their fleet would be still higher, for the entire bug battle line was belching Afhawks. The Orion survivors broke off to rearm and reorganize around their casualties, and the bugs waited until they had been recovered for rearming, then sent all 200 remaining gunboats in to kill the carriers while they were helpless in their bays.
but Diego Jackson's CSP charged to meet them. The carrier's escorts and the battle line raced to interpose between them and the gunboats, raking the incoming strike with fire. But it was Jackson's outnumbered fighters who broke the attacks back. They paid for it with 61 Terran fighters, and they didn't stop them all. That was perhaps the most terrifying thing about a mass suicide attack. When the attackers were intent on dying anyway, some always got through. The leakers slammed into TG-37.1 like hammers, and the Tabby fleet carriers were their primary targets. Itarubul tore apart under a hurricane of missiles and kamikazes, and Sershakan and Itumak were hit hard, especially Itumak. Half the big carrier's hangar bays were reduced to ruin, taking their fighters with them. Yet she was luckier than the CVL Giordani and Rimantus. Both light carriers disappeared in the terrible glare of nuclear fusion, and the Terran Bonhomme Richard went with them. But agonizing as the personnel casualties were, fighters' losses were worse. Coupled with the effect of that first dreadful AFHAWK broadside and the CSP's dogfight, half of TF-37's total fighter strength had been written off in less than 20 minutes, and those fighters had been Zarnak's main battery. His entire plan had been based on staying beyond shipboard range and battering the enemy to death with fighter strikes. But if the bugs had AFHAWKs...
"I fear we must increase our fighter loss projections by at least a factor of 2 in light of the enemy's possession of the AFHAWK Great Claw,"
Least Claw Thera said heavily. He sat with his commander before a subdivided comm screen which held the faces of Diego Jackson and his ops officer, as well as Raymond Prescott and Alexander Lafroy.
"Given the losses we have already suffered," he went on somberly, "I cannot guarantee success if we continue the attack."
"Wait a minute, Thera." It was a sign of the Least Claw's concern that he didn't even wince as Jackson's atrocious Terran accent mangled his name. "We're hurt, sure, but we're not out of this yet. Your boys and girls kicked hell out of their carbines, and my people finished off virtually all their gunboats. We can still take these bastards." Thera let his earbud translate, then sighed.
"I admire your spirit, Commodore, but I'm not certain I share your confidence. Our surviving strike groups are badly disorganized. It will take hours to restore their efficiency, during which the enemy will reach the warp point. The prudent course would be to withdraw to Alawan to reorganize. Yet I fear that is impractical."
"Truth, Least Claw," Prescott said. "We have exhausted our SBM hawks, and without them we cannot force a return to the system once we retreat." "On the other hand," Lafroy pointed out, "we have knocked hell out of their gunboats. If nothing else, we've ensured that they can't take Alawan before Lord Kiniak arrives." "I didn't come here to lose, Alec," said Prescott harshly. "I came here to relieve Hanau." Zarnak hid a flicker of bitter amusement. "How odd. Humans say we do not know how to give ground, yet it is Thera who counsels caution and humans who reject his words." "Damn right," Jackson growled. "I've had it with these things, and I want their asses." "I realize that, sir," Lafroy said respectfully, reminding himself Jackson was a fighter jock by training and inclination. "I'm simply pointing out that we've already achieved our minimum objective."
"You are correct, Commander Lafroy," Zarnak said, "as are you, Thera. Yet, as Great Claw Prescott says, I did not come here to lose. So I ask you, is Commodore Jackson correct? Can we complete the enemy's destruction?"
The Least Claw sat silent for several seconds, eyes straying to the plot on which the bug battle line advanced towards the warp point. If TF-37 meant to retreat before the enemy's missiles could command the point, it must begin its withdrawal within the next 15 minutes. Thera disliked being the voice of caution. It felt unnatural and somehow sordid.
yet it was also his job, and he closed his eyes and thought furiously. Then he sighed.
"I do not know, Great Claw," he said finally. "Certainly we can do them great damage, but to destroy them will require our battle line to accept action. We cannot